Hi, podcasters. This is Andy Studna, editor of Applied Clinical Trials. And for today's episode, we are speaking with Dr. Sindhu Ramchandran, director, clinical leader, neuroscience at Janssen. Before starting her current role with Janssen in January of 2021, Sindhu spent 3 years with PRA Health Sciences as the medical director of neurology. She also has over 9 years of experience as an assistant professor of neurology with the University of Michigan and Wayne State. So thank you so much for joining me today, Sindhu.
Thank you for having me.
The first question I want to get into is, you have extensive academic and professional experience in neurology. So can you share with the audience what got you interested in the field of neurology?
Most of us know someone in our family or a close friend who have been impacted by neurologic diseases, and I'm certainly no different. But my interest in neurology started with the actual science. So as an undergrad, I majored in neuroscience and classics, which is a discussion for another day. But with neuroscience, I found it fascinating that specific regions in our brain controls all aspects of who we are, how we think, what we do. And based on symptoms, you can predict what area of the brain has been affected, that you can link a problem in one location of the brain with the disease.
Great, thank you. So you've also been a PI on neuromuscular trials and also involved in patient care. What is the importance of having practicing physicians involved in clinical trials?
So in neurology, more so than many specialties, as you know, until recently, there were very limited treatment options you could offer your patients. And I've read this before, and it's really true. When your house is always on fire, you want to be a fireman. I think being a part of clinical trials as a practicing physician allows you that opportunity to make a difference, to really work towards bringing better treatments for your patients.
Just following that, what are the challenges in running successful clinical trials in the neurology or the neuromuscular space?
In neurology and specifically in neuromuscular diseases, the number of qualified specialists in your disease who are actively involved in trials are low. And these specialists tend to congregate in major academic centers, which have more access to resources for research. So unfortunately, that means that patients have challenges to access these specialists. And participating in trials gets especially challenging because traveling to those sites may mean, you know, miss school days if you're a child, or work days if you're a working parent or a working adult, or not having a caregiver who can transport you if you're elderly and you cannot travel on your own. So recruitment and retention, I think, is a very specific challenge in trials that we're always working towards mitigating.
You mentioned that, you know, mostly they go to academic centers. In your opinion, how do you think we can identify that challenge?
I think one way that this may change in the future is that the new scientific discoveries, we are finding digital endpoints and biomarkers more helpful in these trials. And I think the more endpoints such as these that we can identify, we could limit the number of visits that's needed to a far-off trial site, a far-off academic center, and get most of the assessments really done closer to the patient's home where they are. And that could really open up clinical trials to be more equitable.
Can you describe your work in rare diseases?
Sure. So as you alluded to, I was previously in academics. I was the director of a muscular dystrophy clinic and a Charcot-Marie-Tooth Disease Center of Excellence clinic, where I had the privilege really to take care of patients with rare neurologic diseases. Currently, I am the director of clinical development at Janssen Neuroscience and the clinical leader of the adult and pediatric myasthenia gravis programs. That means I lead a cross-functional team of experts in designing and conducting trials to test new therapies for myasthenia gravis, which is a rare neurologic disease.
Great, thank you. Just following that, could you maybe share some more specifics on the work that you're currently doing with that?
Of course. So to understand myasthenia gravis, I think you need to understand how the immune system works initially. So your body recognizes what is self, what is meant to be in your body, and what is foreign. So when viruses, bacteria invade your body, the immune system recognizes pieces and portions of it, creates an autoantibody, or creates an antibody rather, to bind to it, which then tells your immune system, this is foreign, this is targeted for destruction. Now, in a healthy, functional human being, that process is great. Unfortunately, what happens in autoantibody-mediated diseases is that your body recognizes self as foreign. So specifically in myasthenia gravis, your immune system starts forming autoantibodies to proteins that disrupt the communication between nerves and muscles. So that results in the symptoms of myasthenia, the weakness, the fatigue, and double vision, and difficulty breathing, etc. So what the current standard of care has been to date has been broad immunosuppressants, broad immunomodulation. And some of the problems with these treatments is that they have a slow onset of action. Some of them may take about 6 months to a year to really see an effect, and they're associated with significant side effects. And this, as you can imagine, can have a really amplified effect on children who have myasthenia, women of childbearing age who may not want to take a medication that could impact their child, and also the elderly who may have reasons for not being on broad immunosuppression because they're more susceptible to infections. So really, then that narrows down how many treatment options that are available to these patients. And then on top of that, only about 20% of patients do not even respond to these current treatments. So given this, we know that there's a significant unmet need for better treatments. And what we're really excited about with nipocalimab is it targets a very specific way that your immune system keeps these autoantibodies in circulation. So there's a receptor called the FcRn, the neonatal Fc receptor, which is present throughout your body, and it basically recycles your immunoglobulins. Normally, that's a good thing because that means your body has to put less effort into keeping your immune system active and going. But in an autoantibody-mediated disease like myasthenia, it's circulating these autoantibodies. Nipocalimab is an FcRn blocker. So it prevents your body from recycling these autoantibodies. So it can lower these autoantibodies. And theoretically, this could lead to tremendous symptom improvement. Now, I say theoretical, we do have a phase 2 study that did provide evidence that this is helpful in patients with myasthenia gravis, in adult patients with myasthenia gravis. But we are conducting currently an adult phase 3 study to look at the safety and efficacy of nipocalimab in adults with myasthenia. And we are also conducting a phase 2-3 study in children who have myasthenia to see how much this can improve their symptoms.
Hey, wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing all that and taking me through that. In regard to treatments after diagnosis, can you explain some of the issues patients have with available treatments?
Absolutely. So as I was alluding to, some of these available treatments in 20% of our current patient population, they don't even respond to. But even in those that do partially respond to these treatments, they experience tremendous side effects and they have an extreme slow onset of action. One of the ways that we believe nipocalimab can be helpful is nipocalimab in the phase 2 study showed a very rapid onset of action. So within 1 to 2 weeks, there was an improvement seen in symptoms. It also showed a sustained duration of action. So once you were started on the treatment and continued on it, you were able to retain that improvement. I think these kind of immediate, quick answers are very critical for patients and providers because currently the standard of care options, it's sort of a watch and wait game. You start a patient on an immune suppressant and you wait for 6 months to a year to see if there's any difference. And if it's not, then you take them off it and start them on something else. So as you can imagine, patients and providers really would like a treatment that allows them to make that quick decision of, yes, this is working and I can continue on this treatment.
Now, in the past few responses that we've already introduced nipocalimab into the conversation, but is there anything else that you can describe or elaborate on in your research in exploring the therapy?
Of course. I think personally, to me, it's a really exciting time for autoantibody diseases because in general, we know that there's such a significant unmet need. And there's really a need for targeted and faster effective treatments with fewer side effects in this patient population. And I think nipocalimab's mechanism of action, which targets really the root cause, the autoantibodies, really has immense potential in many autoantibody diseases. Because we are not suppressing the immune system, we are just preventing that one aspect of it, the recycling of the autoantibodies. That means that you'll still have, your immune system still has the chance to fight infections and to prevent infections. So again, we are testing this in our pivotal studies, but I think that is the promise of nipocalimab, that you can have control of your disease symptoms without necessarily impacting how you react to other infections.
Wonderful. Thank you. Last question to kind of wrap this up here and put a bow on this conversation. Where do you see this therapeutic area in the next, say, 5 to 10 years?
This has really been a very exciting time for neurology, neuromuscular diseases, specifically for me, again, coming from a background of not having that many options, constantly feeling like your house is on fire, you know, and trying to come up with therapies that can help your patients. I think I am really, really delighted to see this explosion in interest in rare neurologic diseases. And I honestly believe that in 5 to 10 years, patients and providers will have so many better options in their arsenal of what they can do to combat the effects of these diseases. And many of these diseases will become something sort of minor and in the background and not getting in the way of them leading full, healthy lives.
Just out of curiosity to follow up on that, you know, you said that we're kind of in an explosion with the interest in the area now. So what was the space for this therapeutic area like, say, 5, 10 years in the past from now?
In the past, when I was a practicing physician, it was challenging because, again, we would have patients who could not be started on steroids. Let's say they had diabetes, for example, and steroids was just not an option for them because it would cause their disease to flare. Immunosuppression was not an option for them because they were elderly and they had other comorbidities. So it was just incredibly challenging. You would have these frail patients really coming into clinic with their families, and it was a lot of trial and error. You keep trying a medication and they would have to come back very frequently every 2-3 weeks just to see, are you doing okay? Is this something that can be increased? Is this something that needs to be changed? Lots of labs to see, are they having side effects of these treatments that we have started? So a lot of burden was really placed, unfortunately, on the patients and their families in order to achieve good disease control. And even now, honestly, you can go to YouTube or any online blog and see patients with rare disease talk about the number of pills that they have to take and the number of times a day they have to take in order to keep their disease under control. So I think that's something that keeps coming up over and over again, this lack of feeling of control over their disease state, of knowing that I have it under control. This is predictable. If I take this, I will be okay. And I think that's where the space is heading now. And that's really exciting.
Obviously, great to hear that the space is trending upwards now. So on that note, is there anything else that you would like to discuss that we haven't hit on yet?
Again, I would just like to close on saying this is just a really exciting time for autoantibody diseases. And I think we're really especially excited about how we can meet this unmet need here at Janssen.
Okay, great. Well, once again, thank you so much for your time today, Sindhu. I really enjoyed our conversation and this was great. Thank you so much again.
Thank you.